Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week at this time by Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster, and this episode, on Thursday, July 10th, 2025, will feature articles that appeared in the Arizona Mirror over the past week. Since this program airs only once a week, some of the articles may be a bit dated, and breaking stories may be added toward the end. The Arizona Mirror is an independent publication which sources stories from all over the state and the nation. We will focus primarily on stories that impact people in Arizona. In this week's episode, these are some of the stories we'll be reading. Part of our culture, Navajo Nation's Oak Ridge fire response includes livestock. As AZ lawmakers oppose Trump's tariffs on Mexican tomatoes, Florida farmers cheer the move. Record 174 vetoes highlight Arizona's partisan gridlock under divided government. Climate change pushes Arizona into uncharted territory with deadly heat. And let's get started. Our first story this week, part of our culture. Navajo Nation's Oak Ridge fire response includes livestock. By Shondine Silversmith, July 7, 2025. As the Oak Ridge fire continued to spread southwest of the Navajo Nation capital last week, families living in the fire's path not only scrambled to save what they could from their homes, but many also had to rescue their animals and livestock. Even as the fire grew, a majority of Navajo families living in the immediate evacuation homes refused to leave because they did not want to abandon their livestock. It was really heartbreaking, Navajo Nation Delegate Brenda Jesus said. She represents the St. Michael's and Oak Springs chapter and has been on the ground helping the impacted communities since the fire started. For many families on the Navajo Nation, livestock is their livelihood. They rely on their livestock to support their family. I'm not leaving if I can't take my livestock. I'm not going to leave my livestock behind. Craig Zutzi, vice president of St. Michael's chapter, said he was told by many families during the peak of evacuations after the fire started on June 28th. Zutzi said the only way many families in evacuation zones felt comfortable leaving their homes was if their livestock also got out. The Navajo Department of Agriculture, Forestry, Fish and Wildlife, Navajo Park Rangers, and Resource Enforcement have been on site in Window Rock since the fire began and have been actively assisting families who need their livestock evacuated. The Department of Agriculture announced on its Facebook page that the Dean Jackson Arena on the Navajo Nation Fairgrounds was open to evacuated livestock as of June 28th. The department established a livestock evacuation team that families affected by the disaster could contact to coordinate evacuation assistance. Veterinary staff were on site at the fairgrounds to monitor the animals as they arrived. The livestock were fed and watered daily. Zutzi said he was glad the Department of Agriculture stepped up and mobilized to work with families to save their livestock. They provided trucks, trailers, and they were limited on their end to what they could do, he said. They couldn't be everywhere at once. Zutzi said many of the teams working to evacuate livestock were out on the ground in Hunters Point, Oak Springs, and St. Michael's, helping owners load their livestock onto trailers at all hours of the night. There were days when he was out until 3 a.m. Even as they worked to evacuate livestock, Zutzi said there was some frustration from the community, potentially due to the long wait times or miscommunication. He said he hopes people understand that it was whole communities that were impacted and needed assistance. It wasn't just a couple of people, he added. Everybody in those fire zones that were getting evacuated needed livestock evacuated along with them. As of July 4th, the department had evacuated 39 cattle, 236 sheep, 27 chickens, 21 goats, 16 horses, 7 dogs, 4 hogs, and 2 turkeys, according to the Navajo Nation President's Office. Dene volunteers help evacuated sheep. As a way to help the sheep and owners impacted by the Oak Ridge Fire, a group of volunteers banded together at the Dean Jackson Arena on July 4th to give a flock of sheep a much-needed haircut. A lot of families are going to receive their sheep back better than they brought them in, Tootsie said, of the sheep shearing provided by the volunteers. During the summer month, sheep are sheared to help them handle the heat and stay healthy. Sheep have thick wool, and unshorn sheep often experience extra stress and potential health problems during hot summer temperatures. They're reliant on their shepherds to shear them, Dene Shepherd Nikhail Begay said. If they don't get sheared, they could potentially get fly strike, a condition where flies lay their eggs within the sheep's wool. Maggots will work their way into the sheep's skin, infecting the sheep and basically eating it, he said. To help keep the sheep healthy and ease some of the stress from the owners, Dene Shepherds Jay Begay from Hard Rock, Arizona, and Nikhail Begay from Cornfields, Arizona, put a call out on social media for volunteers to help them shear the sheep impacted by the Oak Ridge Fire. With more than 200 sheep evacuated from the fire, there were a few flocks that were not sheared for the summer. Many flocks are shepherded by elders who probably had shearing planned for the summer, but instead they were displaced by the fire, Nikhail said. We just wanted to ease whatever worries they might have and offer our services. Working with the Navajo Department of Agriculture, they were able to arrange a shearing event for the sheep. This is a way for us to help without being in the way and helping the best way we know how, Nikhail said, adding that when they put out the call, the response was immediate. The response, Nikhail said, is because they are part of a great community of shepherds, fiber artists, and those who admire sheep. Shearers from across the Navajo Nation showed up to help give haircuts to nearly 80 sheep, each of them taking one animal at a time throughout the day. Tarps and plyboards were laid out on the dirt floor in different areas of the arena for volunteers to use to hand shear the sheep. The sheep varied in size from small lambs to full-grown rams. The volunteer shearer would take a sheep, tie off the legs if needed, and hold the sheep down to be sheared using sharp shearing scissors. After the volunteers were done shearing, the wool was collected and saved in bags for the owners. A total of 18 volunteers showed up to help with the sheep, Nikhail said, and 10 stayed throughout the day. Sheep are an integral part of our culture, Nikhail said. They've always been. They've made their place within ceremonies and everyday life. For more information about the event and the shearing work, Nikhail can be reached on Instagram at Navajo Shepherd. And that concludes this story, Part of Our Culture, Navajo Nation's Oak Ridge Fire Response Includes Livestock. Our second story, as AZ lawmakers oppose Trump's tariffs on Mexican tomatoes, FL farmers cheer the move. We've been decimated, a longtime Florida tomato grower says about the industry in the Sunshine State, by Mitch Perry of Florida Phoenix, July 8, 2025. The U.S. Department of Commerce announcement that it will withdraw from an agreement with Mexico controlling tomato imports is being applauded by Florida lawmakers who say it will allow Florida and other U.S. farmers to catch up to what the agency has labeled, quote, unfairly produced Mexican imports. But the proposal is fiercely opposed by lawmakers in Arizona and Texas, who claim the tariff being placed on Mexican tomatoes will harm their own economies and provide consumers with less choice and higher prices. There's no question that right now the winners in this situation are Florida tomato growers, who for years have been calling upon the Commerce Department to terminate the 2019 Tomato Suspension Agreement, TSA. They contend that growers in Mexico have been selling their products at below U.S. market prices, a practice known as, quote, dumping. The Commerce Department's decision, announced in April, means there will soon be a 17.09% tariff on Mexican tomatoes, which now dominate the U.S. market. The termination of the suspension agreement will allow U.S. tomato growers to compete fairly in the marketplace, reads a letter penned by Senators Rick Scott and Ashley Moody and a dozen Florida Republican U.S. House members upon the announcement that the TSA will be terminated. This has been a priority of ours for years, added North Central Florida GOP U.S. Representative Kat Kamek in a separate statement. For half a decade now, our producers have been subject to an unfair marketplace. In the past 5 years alone, Mexican tomato producers have violated the suspension agreement over 100 times. The economic impact of these violations has been catastrophic on our domestic tomato producers. No one disputes that the industry isn't what it once was in the Sunshine State. Industry officials observe that going back to when the first tomato suspension agreement was reached in the mid-1990s, there were almost 300 tomato producers in Florida. Now they say there are just a few more than 30. There have been over 100 incidents documented of violations by the Mexicans by the Commerce Department. So this is just a recurring problem that has devastated our industry, said Tony DeMara, president of DeMara Fresh, a produce repacking and distributing company that started business in Boston 97 years ago and has maintained shipping operations in both California and Florida for decades. In 2023, Florida produced $494 million of fresh market tomatoes, according to the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. That's second only to California in the U.S. However, the Golden State tomatoes are primarily used for processing into products like ketchup, tomato paste, and other sauces, whereas most of Florida's tomato crops are for fresh market consumption. Although the Commerce Department's decision to kill the TSA is a welcome boost for tomato growers in Florida, Georgia, and other states in the South that grow tomatoes, it has been denounced elsewhere, specifically Arizona and Texas. U.S. importers say the tariffs will result in higher costs for them, leading to higher prices for consumers. Last month, Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott signed a resolution encouraging the Department of Commerce to maintain the existing TSA rather than terminate it. In April, Arizona Democratic U.S. Senator Ruben Gallego sent his own letter to Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, calling upon him to keep the suspension agreement in place. The result of terminating this agreement will be higher prices for American families, few options at the grocery store, and fewer American jobs. Indeed, studies show that families could see tomato prices rise by an average of 50% if your department does not reverse course, Gallego wrote. Officials in those states also cite an economic analysis from Texas A&M University published earlier this year, estimating the direct and indirect economic benefits associated with the import and sale of Mexican fresh tomatoes in the U.S. at $8.33 billion, with fresh tomato imports supporting more than 46,000 full-time and part-time jobs across the United States. Robert Gunther, Executive Vice President of the Florida Tomato Exchange, FTE, says that the termination of the TSA will allow U.S. growers to stay in business, keep people employed, and save family farms. And he insists that consumers won't be hit with higher prices. We do not expect any significant changes with retail prices for consumers with the termination of the agreement, he told NPR last month. DeMara noted that when the TSA was terminated for 4 months in 2019, prices actually went down at that period of time. and he rejects terming the penalty on Mexican tomatoes a tariff. He insists it's an anti-dumping penalty for violating U.S. trade law. When we negotiate all of these fair trade agreements, there are parameters, he said. There are guidelines with which trading countries have to comply, and if those guidelines are not adhered to and rules are broken, there are penalties. And the penalties in this case for numerous years of violations of adhering to the minimum reference price is the anti-dumping duties. The Greenhouse Revolution. The first tomato suspension agreement between the United States and Mexico was enacted on November 1, 1996, nearly 3 years after NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, began. The rules evolved following an anti-dumping investigation aimed at detecting whether fresh tomatoes from Mexico were being sold at less than fair market value. Under the 96 TSA, Mexican producers agreed to sell fresh tomatoes in the United States at set reference prices, with the U.S. suspending the anti-dumping investigation. Since then, revised suspension agreements were reached in 2002, 2008, 2013, and most recently on September 19, 2019. In 2023, FTE, the Florida Exchange, asked the Department of Commerce to terminate the 2019 agreement, saying lingering loopholes remained a problem. It's become clear that these agreements are simply not enforceable, at least when it comes to the tomato trade with Mexico, said Michael Shadler, then executive vice president of the FTE. Suspension agreements might be an effective tool for products that can be kept in storage until market conditions improve, but for highly perishable items like fresh tomatoes, there is just too much incentive to evade the reference prices when markets are oversupplied. However, representatives from other parts of the country argue the tomato market has evolved since the mid-1990s, when the first suspension agreement went into effect. Mexican imports have superseded Florida's homegrown tomatoes because of what they call the, quote, greenhouse revolution, a new way of farming embraced by Mexican, Canadian, and some U.S. tomato growers, but not in Florida. By the early 2020s, greenhouse tomatoes represented 60% of the total fresh tomato import volume, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA. By investing in greenhouse technology, Mexican growers have been able to grow specialty tomatoes versus the mainly round tomatoes produced in Florida, said Skip Hewlett, chief legal officer of NatureSweet, a Texas company that grows and sells greenhouse tomatoes in Mexico and the United States. The market has evolved dramatically since 1995 to 1996, and so consumers now expect the greenhouse-grown vine-ripe varieties like the grape and the cherry, many of which didn't exist in the 90s, he said. The domestic growers who petitioned Commerce for duties have failed to innovate, growing what in the industry are called, quote, gas-green tomatoes, or round tomatoes that are picked green and then induced to turn a pale red after being placed in gas rooms and exposed to ethylene gas, the Fresh Produce Association of the Americas said in a press release. This kind of tomato has lost market share as consumers and restaurants have shifted to tomato varieties that naturally ripen on the plant, just like in nature, with a natural deep red color and superior flavor. DeMar objects to that claim. Yes, the Mexican industry has shifted their way of growing to a greenhouse product, but the actual production of the type of tomatoes is the same, whether it's greenhouse produced or open field produced, he said. A round tomato is a round tomato. A Roma tomato is a Roma tomato, and we all share and compete at times in the marketplace with our products. A matter of taste. William Alexander is the author of 2022's 10 Tomatoes That Changed the World, A History of the Tomato. He argues the problem with Florida tomatoes is that they're not bred to taste good. That's a quote. Quote, not bread to taste good. These are green and rock hard, and they're bred for all kinds of things. To look pretty, to look fresh after they're sliced, to look exactly the right size, to withstand all of the horrible weather that you can have in Florida. And they're not able to do all of that, and also to breed for flavor, he told the Phoenix. Alexander recently wrote in an op-ed in the New York Times, contending that the last thing that American consumers need is a revitalization of Florida's withering tomato industry. Florida's natural environment isn't conducive to producing great tomatoes, Alexander said, referring to the fact that they're grown in sandy soil. That sand never freezes, unlike a New Jersey field, and so it never kills off things like nematodes, he said. For his part, Robert Gunther of the Florida Tomato Exchange told NPR recently that there are no differences between quality, freshness, taste of tomatoes. With the clock ticking before the TSA is officially terminated, the lobbying is expected to prove intense on both sides of the issue. Whether that will result in a higher price of tomatoes is unclear. We certainly anticipate that if the tariffs do go into effect, said Tom Stenzel, executive director of the Controlled Environment Agriculture Alliance, a membership trade association representing greenhouse producers growing fruits and vegetables in a controlled indoor environment. That is not going to happen, DeMar insists. I don't see the prices are going to escalate because the agreement is going to terminate. The termination of the TSA is set for July 14th. And there's a note here that Florida Phoenix is part of State's Newsroom, a nonprofit news network supported by grants and a coalition of donors as a 501c3 public charity. And that concludes this story. As AZ lawmakers oppose Trump's tariffs on Mexican tomatoes, FL farmers cheer the move. We now move on to our next story. Record 174 vetoes highlight Arizona's partisan gridlock under divided government. Governor rejects Republican bills while GOP committee chairs block Democratic proposals from consideration. By Caitlin Sievers, July 3, 2025. In Arizona, a divided state government means elected leaders spend a lot of their time blocking one another's policy proposals instead of creating bipartisan compromise. Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs signed into law 265 pieces of legislation that had bipartisan support, but she also beat her own veto record, throwing 174 bills into the trash bin. That shatters the previous record, one Hobbs set in 2023, her first year in the governor's office, when she rejected 143 GOP-backed bills. The bills that Hobbs vetoed were debated, amended, and discussed in public view in legislative committees and on the floor of both chambers before Republican legislators voted to pass them and send them to the governor. The overwhelming majority of legislation proposed by Democrats was never considered at all. In the legislative session that began January 13th and ended 165 days later on June 27th, legislators from both parties introduced a total of 1,854 pieces of legislation, 1,250 sponsored by Republicans, and 604 that were brought forth by Democrats. Of the 439 bills that ultimately passed through both chambers and were sent to Hobbs' desk, only 10 were introduced by Democrats. That's because the Republican Senate President and House Speaker appoint committee chairmen who decide which bills get a committee hearing. Bills must get committee approval before being sent to the full House of Representatives or Senate for consideration. And with Republicans heading every committee, those chairmen have incredible power to block bills they don't like, even if they know that those proposals would have enough support to get a passing vote from the whole chamber. House Democrats aired their frustration with this practice after a late evening vote on the state budget on June 26th, when Republican Representative Alexander Colladin attempted to make a rule change limiting each legislator to proposing 7 bills each session. He claimed that lawmakers from both sides of the aisle had complained to him that committees were overwhelmed with the number of bills being proposed without time to properly vet each one. Colladin himself sponsored 74 bills this year, but claimed he did so to prove his point that a cap was necessary. "I knew that this body would not get desperate to change the rule to 7 until the system was well and thoroughly overwhelmed," he said. And guess what? The system was well and thoroughly overwhelmed. The House actually does have a 7-bill limit, but it's designed in a way to let lawmakers effectively introduce many more bills than that. The limit applies only to bills introduced after the first week of the annual legislative session. That means measures filed during the first work week or before session begins don't count against the limit. Colladin's proposal was swiftly voted down with ample criticism from Republicans and Democrats. Democrats argued that their main source of exasperation came from never having their bills heard in committee at all. Representative Lorena Austin, a Democrat from Mesa, said that not a single bill they've proposed in 3 years has gotten a committee hearing, even ones they say were not egregiously partisan. There were over 1,800 bills submitted, and here in the House, only 38 were heard from Democrats, and only 12 in the Senate were from Democrats, Austin said. Representative Stephanie Stahl Hamilton, a Democrat from Tucson, said that a government truly representative of the voters would at least give more Democratic bills a chance. "I was very appreciative of actually having one of my bills get a hearing in committee," she said. "That has never happened before." With a 33-27 split in the House and 17-13 in the Senate, 56% of Arizona legislators are Republicans and 44% are Democrats. But with only 10 out of the 439 bills sent to the governor this year sponsored by Democrats, that means a paltry 2.3% of the legislation that had a chance of becoming law was introduced by the minority party. Even with 255 Republican-sponsored bills signed into law this year, many of their proposals were blocked with vetoes. In most cases, the sponsors of those bills knew the vetoes were coming. Hobbs promised to nix any anti-trans legislation and any bills that she believed would make the voting process more difficult, and broadly refuses to sign any bills that lacked bipartisan support. Republican Representative David Livingston, a Republican from Peoria, repeatedly bragged that his two packages of failed budget proposals meant he achieved the most Hobbs vetoes from a single legislator in one day, 28. House Republicans' refusal to work with Senate Republicans, Democrats from both chambers, and Hobbs to craft a bipartisan budget before the June 30th deadline led to weeks of long nights ahead of the final budget passage on June 27th. It also created hostility between Republicans, who acknowledged a need to compromise with Democrats, and members of the far-right Arizona Freedom Caucus, who insist their wish list be included without regard for any of the other lawmakers involved in the budgeting process. "We have to wait for a Republican governor. That's just the reality," Senator John Kavanaugh, the Senate's chief budget negotiator, said during debate on the Senate floor on June 19th. Kavanaugh was reacting to a slew of conservative amendments to the spending plan from the Freedom Caucus that would have blown up the budget deal and elicited a veto from Hobbs. With Republican bills that lacked Democratic support blocked by vetoes, and most Democratic legislation blocked by committee chairmen, as well as a slew of Republican bills similar to one another with slight policy variations that must be consolidated, most legislation proposed this year ended up in the garbage bin. Many bills that passed through both chambers with bipartisan support and were signed by the governor included minor law changes, such as making certain specialty license plates available or tweaking certification requirements for professional licenses. But there were also several significant pieces of bipartisan legislation passed this year, including House Bill 2704, which gives $500 million in sales taxes over the next 30 years to the Diamondbacks for improvement to Chase Field. Senate Bill 1500, which provides compensation to wrongfully incarcerated for each year they were imprisoned and funds their mental health treatment. House Bill 2945, which prevented the Division of Developmental Disabilities from going broke before the end of the fiscal year, which would have caused 60,000 people with disabilities to lose vital services. House Bill 2581, which creates a sexual assault kit tracking system. House Bill 2281, which creates a missing Indigenous person alert system. The legislature also approved three resolutions this session, with only Republican support, that bypassed a veto from the governor and will be sent directly to the ballot in 2026 for the voters to decide. They are House Concurrent Resolution 2021, which would cap local municipal sales taxes on groceries, House Concurrent Resolution 2055, which would classify drug cartels as terrorist organizations, Senate Concurrent Resolution 1004, which would prohibit the state from taxing drivers based on the number of miles driven. And that concludes this story. Record 174 vetoes highlight Arizona's partisan gridlock under divided government. You're listening to the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week at this time by Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster. Moving on to the second part of our program, here's what Maricopa County voters should do if they get proof of citizenship request. Two letters went out. One was a mistake. The other one explains how to ensure you can keep voting in state and local elections. By Jen Fifield of VoteBeat, July 9, 2025. Maricopa County voters who recently received letters from the recorder's office about their registration status may be confused by the two separate mailings, including one that's incorrect. But no matter what, they will need to act soon to make sure they are able to continue to vote in state and local elections. The recorder's office sent the first letter out in error to 83,000 voters, telling them the office had gotten notice that they had moved out of state and they would be removed from the active voter rolls if they didn't act. Flummoxed voters began receiving those mailings on June 26th. The office then sent out the mailing that voters were supposed to get, with an added explanation in bold at the top, explaining that the initial mailing was a mistake. This letter told voters about how they would need to provide documentation proving their U.S. citizenship because of a separate error that affected 200,000 voters statewide. In Maricopa County, those voters will have 90 days to respond with a birth certificate, passport, or other document. If they do not, they will be classified as federal-only voters and permitted to vote only in presidential and congressional races. The letters prompted widespread confusion among recipients and demands for an explanation. After the incorrect letter went out, average wait times at the county's call center jumped from just seconds to 10 minutes or more for 3 days and peaked at more than 40 minutes, according to data VoteBeat obtained through public records requests. The recorder's office did not make a public statement about the incorrect letters for more than a day after voters began to receive them, which meant public officials and residents searching for information from the office could not find any. VoteBeat first reported the incorrect mailing on June 26th, and many voters said this story provided the only information they were able to obtain. Many voters later told VoteBeat that they believed the letter was a sign of something nefarious. My wife and I both got one, and thought someone had used info of ours from a data leak to take out fraudulent IDs, said Shane Watson of Phoenix. Christopher Blisnick of Phoenix said he thought it was some sort of voter suppression. I thought they were trying to passively push people off the voter rolls, he said. Why some longtime Arizona voters are being asked to prove their citizenship. The letters to voters are part of the effort underway in all Arizona counties to correct a state record-keeping error that was disclosed last summer. For 20 years, the state said, it had failed to collect documentary proof of U.S. citizenship for some voters when they first registered to vote or updated their registration after moving across county lines. About 200,000 voters, or roughly 5% of the state's voter roll, were caught up in that error, including the 83,000 Maricopa County voters who received the letters from the recorder's office. These voters are all longtime residents, and some have lived in Arizona and have been registered to vote for decades. But because state law requires proof of citizenship to vote in state and local elections, these voters will now need to provide that proof to continue to vote a full ballot. Federal law does not require documentary proof of citizenship. It requires voters to attest to their citizenship under penalty of perjury. Arizona voters who do not provide citizenship proof can still vote in federal elections because they have already attested to their citizenship when registering to vote. What Maricopa County voters should do if they receive the letters. In Maricopa County, the second letter, which is dated June 27th at the top, explains how affected voters can resolve the problem. The voters can use the return envelope provided to send back their name, address, and a copy of a document proving their citizenship, such as a birth certificate or a passport. The voters can also send the documentation by email to voterinfo, that's VOTERINFO, at maricopa.gov, or bring the documentation to the recorder's office at 301 West Jefferson Street in Phoenix. Voters in other counties who have received similar letters should contact their recorder's office to learn how to fix the problem. The Secretary of State's office initially provided a way for voters to check online whether they were on the list of affected voters, but isn't doing that anymore. Voters who have questions about their record can contact their county recorder's office. Why incorrect letters went out? Maricopa County Recorder Justin Heap and his staff at first blamed Complete Print Shop, a vendor the office hired to send the letters, for the incorrect mailing. The office said in its first statement that the vendor has taken full responsibility for the mistake. But emails first reported by 12 News on June 30th showed an employee of the recorder's office had approved a proof of the incorrect letter. And in an email sent a few days after the error was uncovered, a Complete Print Shop employee told a county staff member looking into the issue that the proof using the wrong template was sent and approved by the recorder's office. Nonetheless, the email showed that Complete Print Shop said the mailing of the incorrect letter constituted a mistake on its part and confirmed that it would mail a corrected letter at its own expense. After those emails were publicly released, he put out a second statement confirming that his office had erroneously approved the proof of the incorrect letter. Complete Print Shop did not respond to phone calls and emails requesting comment. Longtime voters outside of Maricopa County are also being asked to prove citizenship. The 83,000 Maricopa County voters who received the letters are among the 200,000 voters in the state who are being asked to prove their citizenship because of the state error. Counties are notifying voters on their own timelines with their own processes to collect the documentation. Secretary of State Adrian Fontes at first mentioned creating an online portal where voters could securely upload their documents, but that did not occur, and counties instead are left to collect the documents through whatever methods they can. the requests for documents have confused voters across the state, and the consequences for voters who don't provide the documents will depend on the county they live in. Maricopa County is making them federal-only voters, while other counties currently plan to eventually take the voters off of the rolls entirely or make no change to their voter status at all. Attorney General Chris Mays is expected to issue a formal opinion on how counties should resolve the registration status of people who don't provide a citizenship proof in time. And that concludes this story. Here's what Maricopa County voters should do if they get proof of citizenship request. Our next story is an update on the Oak Ridge fire. Next, we have an update on an earlier story. With the Oak Ridge fire mostly contained, the work shifts to the tough job of recovery. Community volunteers and chapter officials provided door-to-door support during unprecedented fire response. By Shondine Silversmith, July 8, 2025. As the evacuation orders are lifted and the Oak Ridge fire reaches 87% containment, families on the Navajo Nation can begin focusing on recovery as they deal with the aftermath of a wildfire that has so far burned more than 11,000 acres over 10 days. Hundreds of firefighters responded to the wildfire and have been on the ground in the Oak Ridge area of the Navajo Nation near Window Rock, battling a blaze that the surrounding communities have never experienced before. Initially, the firefighters faced high temperatures, strong winds, and dry conditions as the fire quickly expanded from 1,000 to 6,000 acres and eventually to 10,000 acres over the first few days with no containment. First responders caught a break when the weather shifted slightly, providing the area with some rain the first few days of July. The first containment report was issued on July 3rd, indicating a 6% containment rate. The fire has burned 11,027 acres as of July 8th, according to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Navajo Region. The containment efforts were the result of the diligence of the firefighters, the BIA stated, which allowed them to secure additional line in areas that were previously uncontained. The Navajo Nation Police Department, BIA Navajo Region, and Southwest Complex Incident Management Team 2 lifted all evacuation statuses in all zones on Tuesday morning. No evacuations of any type are in effect, the responding agencies said. All residents are allowed to return to their residences. Even as the evacuation orders are lifted, the Navajo Nation Police Department has issued a public safety closure surrounding the fire area, as it remains an active incident with firefighters and equipment working to achieve full containment of the fire. Hazards such as stump holes, ash pits, and hazardous trees still exist within the fire footprint, according to the responding agencies. Additionally, members of the Burn Area Emergency Response Team will collect valuable data for post-fire recovery and response. The public is asked to abide by this closure and to not enter the area, they stated. The evacuation centers at the Ganado Fieldhouse and the Window Rock High School Event Center are closed, and the Navajo Nation Department of Management is preparing to pack and distribute donations to local chapter houses in the coming days. No more donations are being accepted for the Oak Ridge fire. Families who had livestock evacuated and are being sheltered at the Navajo Nation Fairground have been advised to work with the Navajo Nation Department of Agriculture to coordinate the pickup and return of their livestock. Hundreds of people responded in different ways to support the communities affected by the Oak Ridge fire, from firefighting and evacuation efforts to donation drives and livestock assistance. Multiple levels of resources and support contributed to the Oak Ridge fire response. For one chapter house, council delegate, and volunteer, their efforts include going door to door, distributing donations, and helping displaced individuals feel more at home. A chapter's response. When the Oak Ridge fire began, officials from the St. Michael's chapter immediately took action and activated their community emergency response team as part of the chapter's emergency response plan. "It's been tough," said St. Michael's chapter Vice President Craig Tutsi, who's been on the ground working with his community since the fire started on June 28th. He served as his chapter's incident commander and led numerous on-the-ground operational efforts to support the community, including going door-to-door to inform people about the fire. Tutsi assisted families in evacuating their livestock and worked closely with volunteers during the donation intake and distribution process. It took the work of volunteers, staff, and elected officials in the area to provide some sense of relief to their community, Tutsi said, because many Navajo people who were impacted were often confused about what to do. "We've been doing the best we can to assist them," he said. St. Michael's chapter president-elect Gabrielle Arviso Freeland said they had a draft of the plan ready to share with the chapter before the fire hit. "We never thought we would use it this quickly," he said. "Since the St. Michael's chapter is its own governing body, it had the power to establish its emergency response team outside the Navajo Nation government's response. It's been intense," he said, "and they have only been successful in their response because of the volunteers and donations that came in to support them. We're only 5 people strong as officials and staff, but with the volunteers, that has allowed us to account for who is going to handle the food distribution and care packages," he added. The chapter house responded to the wildfire in 3 phases. The first was an immediate response, which involved direct fire support from officials at the chapter house. The second was community support, ensuring they had access to resources. And the final phase was recovery, helping the community get back on its feet. The St. Michael's chapter house's proactive response to the Oak Ridge fire was a key part of their reassurance to the community, Tutsi said, because their elected officials are actively helping out the community. Tutsi said they went out to as many houses as they could to warn people about the fire. They worked with families to evacuate their livestock and even took the chapter house's road grading equipment to create fire lines around some of the homes. "We took the dragger out and we made a big old circle around their houses," he said. They did that for about 60 houses from St. Michael's to Hunter's Point. "We didn't go in there blindly," Freeland said of their fire response efforts for the houses. They maintained contact with all the responding agencies and took their historical preservation team with them to ensure they did not disturb any critical areas. The chapter established its incident command operations at St. Michael's Senior Center. They had 5 main areas of operation: incident command, operation lead, kitchen lead, donation lead, and warehouse lead. Chapter house staff documented all donations received to track their origin and the amount provided. Freeland said that it is required as part of their emergency response, and it holds them accountable for donation intake. Tutsi said they served families from Oak Springs, Hunter's Point, and St. Michael's as part of their response efforts, ensuring that individuals directly impacted received the donations. "There was a misconception that the donations were for anyone living in these communities," he said, and he often had to inform the public that they were only for families directly impacted by the fire. The chapter house received donations from various entities on and off the Navajo Nation, including bales of hay, bottled water, snacks, bedding, and hygiene products. Native Health put out a call for donations to support families affected by the Oak Ridge fire and has sent multiple loads of donation to the Navajo Nation, including the St. Michael's Chapter House. Native Health Executive Director Walter Marullo said the extension of this help is part of his organization's commitment to representing the community and addressing their need for aid in Native communities and families across Arizona. On July 4th, Native Health Phoenix board member Kimberly Dutcher delivered a carload of donations to St. Michael's, including bedding, water, snacks, toothbrushes, and more. Native Health is a healthcare agency in Phoenix that offers a variety of programs, including primary medical, dental, and behavioral health services. And we're going to have to leave it there because we have one more story that we would like to bring you. Pulitzer Prize-winning political cartoonist Steve Benson dies at 71. Benson, who spent 5 years as the Mirror's in-house cartoonist, suffered a stroke in 2024. By the Arizona Mirror staff, July 8, 2025. Steve Benson, the Pulitzer Prize-winning political cartoonist, known for his sharp wit and incisive commentary on American politics, has died at the age of 71. After being laid off by the Arizona Republic in 2019, Benson joined the Arizona Mirror shortly after the nonprofit digital news outlet launched. He continued to produce thought-provoking cartoons for the Mirror until his retirement in 2024, capping off a remarkable career that spanned nearly half a century. In spring 2024, Benson suffered a stroke from which he never recovered. Throughout his career, Benson's work appeared in publications such as The Washington Post, The New York Times, and Time Magazine. He was a two-time finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in addition to his win, and received numerous other accolades, including multiple Best Editorial Cartoonist Awards from the National Cartoonist Society. Benson was known for his unflinching approach to political commentary, taking aim at figures across the political spectrum. His cartoons often spark controversy, but he remained committed to his craft, once saying, "If I'm not provoking a reaction, I'm not doing my job." In addition to his work as a cartoonist, Benson was an accomplished public speaker and educator, frequently giving lectures on political cartooning and free speech at universities and conferences across the country. In 2020, Benson married Claire Ferguson, marking a new chapter in his life. He is survived by Claire, his children, and grandchildren. "Steve was the most extraordinary person I have ever met," Ferguson told the Mirror. "He was a brilliant artist, and his cartoons made us all smile, as well as think deeply about political and social issues. And he was a fierce defender of equal rights for all. He was delighted to hear from his readers, whether the comments were favorable or not. His family and I are devastated by this monumental loss." The team at the Arizona Mirror, where Benson spent the final years of his career, remembers him as a passionate advocate for truth and accountability in journalism. His incisive wit and artistic talent will be deeply missed in the newsroom and beyond. "As a native Phoenician, I grew up reading Benson cartoons in the paper every day, like so many other people, and I was always in awe of how he could convey so much in so few strokes of his pen," said Jim Small, the editor-in-chief of the Arizona Mirror. "Having the opportunity to work closely with Steve for nearly 5 years is something that I could never have imagined, and I am so proud of the fact that we were able to be the home for his cartoons. I will forever remember Steve for his giant heart, his unending kindness, his creativity, his piercing sense of humor, and his moral certainty in the face of injustice." And that concludes this article and this tribute. Pulitzer Prize-winning political cartoonist Steve Benson dies at 71. And it looks like we're not going to have time for Jared McDonald Evoy's story on climate change. "Climate change pushes Arizona into uncharted territory with deadly heat." But it's an important story, and so we will definitely put that on the agenda for next week's program. And with that, we conclude this week's edition of the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week at this time by Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster. Remember, if you missed any part of this program or want to hear a story again, you can go to our website, sunsounds.org, and click on Demand Podcasts. And you know you can take Sun Sounds with you by getting our stream and on-demand podcasts on our Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can also hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. And don't forget to spread the word to your friends and neighbors that anyone who is unable to read print for any reason can find lots of great programming on Sunsounds 24/7. Have them check us out at sunsounds.org. Thanks so much for joining us this week. Stay tuned for more great programming from Sunsounds of Arizona, and we'll look forward to seeing you next week.